I'm Stuart Kelter, and this is Delving In. Today's guest, Olivia Campbell, is a journalist, essayist, and author focusing on the intersections of medicine, women, history, and nature. Her work has appeared in The Atlantic, The Washington Post, Smithsonian Magazine, and many other major publications. She's the author of the 2021 New York Times bestseller, Women in White Coats, How the First Women Doctors Changed the World of Medicine, which is the subject of today's interview. So Olivia, welcome to Delving In.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure to be here.
So Olivia, tell us a bit about what led you to take on the incredibly moving project of writing Women in White Coats, which undoubtedly involved untold hours of painstaking research, and then the task of weaving it all together into an engaging, highly readable narrative.
This was a lot. It took a long time, for sure, many years. I was at a book sale recently at the local library system, and someone came up to look and see if they wanted to buy my book. And they said, "What's this?" And I said, "It's 4 years of my life." Yeah, but it was a lot of fun, too. I got to travel. I finished all my research right before COVID hit. So I was in London and Edinburgh and in New York all in the fall of 2019 in the archives, touching the documents. It was electrifying to get to see these people's letters in person and then read them. And so that part was a lot of fun. But once you gathered it all together, it was a lot. There's a lot to dig through. I like to credit my past in journalism with my ability to hone in on the story and the quotes, right? So when you're interviewing someone as a journalist, there's always that moment where you're like, ooh, that's the one, that's the thing I'm going to quote, right? There's the magic lines that you hear your sources say. And I think I'm really good at doing that in written documents as well. So I'm going through all these archives of these people that have been dead for 100 years, but I'm reading their letters and I'm going, ooh, that's the line. This is the piece that says everything I need to know about this person. This is going to tell the story. So that's what I think I'm really good at, is finding those nuggets that tell the story as well as telling you the most about the speaker or what they're speaking about. But the first thing that drew me in to this story was I was reading a magazine about, it was all about the Edinburgh riot that I detail in the book. And then I realized there was another riot that happened in Philadelphia near where I live. It was about a year before that. So I had read this piece in this magazine, and it was all about the struggle of these women to just simply get an education, right? They were just walking to an exam and they were getting things thrown at them. There's drunk guys like screaming at them. They're covering their dresses in mud. They're blocking their entrance to the exam. This is just like a normal thing for us now. Like, we take for granted going to an exam of any gender.
That's a scene that it's definitely going to be in the movie version of the book.
Exactly. That's for sure. And when I first wrote on the proposal for the book, I wanted to include more about the women in Philadelphia. I wanted to be more broad, but the book didn't actually end up, people were more interested in it when I honed in on the three women who founded the London School of Medicine for Women. But I would have loved to write more about the people in Philadelphia as well, because there was this awesome riot there. Oh, my, awesome. It was just unbelievable. The year before, Edinburgh, it was in Philadelphia, they were trying to go. It was a women's medical school in Philadelphia that had been around for a long time. And the head of the school had been pressing to go to this medical lecture for years and years. And finally, the men's college relented and said, okay, you can come to the hospital, you can view this lecture, because it was part of the clinical training, right? These women weren't getting any clinical training. They wanted to be as good as the men's education, but all these roadblocks, they were interfering with the quality of their education. And they're like, we want to do this, we can manage this, we need to go see these surgeries, these case studies being on stage, these live demonstrations. So finally, the school says, yes, you can come. So the men had passed around this note beforehand, the day before, like, oh, the she doctors are coming. You have to, make a stand. You have to make sure they understand their place and they're not ever going to come back. So there's like hundreds of people at this lecture, which is normally, there might be like maybe a max of it or something. So all these men have shown up, probably not even in the medical program or just at the school. And they're screaming at the women, yelling epithets. They're throwing, spitting tobacco spit on them, foil wads, like anything they could think of. They're like stamping their feet in the auditorium and just scream through the whole, they're trying to go through the lecture. They're trying to give the lecture. the administrators come in at random points and are like, okay, you guys need to stop. You guys need to get it together. We're trying to do a lecture here. It just keeps continuing through the whole thing. And the men are chasing them down the street afterward. These two events, of course, I found more and more. There's so many points in history where women were just facing these horrible treatment just for trying to become medical doctors to get a medical education. So this was my entrance into this idea of what they were put through.
So the most dramatic parts of the book are, in fact, what stimulated you to undertake the topic in the first place. So I'd like to ask a couple of questions just to provide some context and background. So you do a masterful job of helping the reader vividly picture a level of societal sexism that used to be taken for granted by almost everyone, both men and women. And you close the book with this paragraph: "A world where only men are physicians seems almost imaginable today. Were it not for these ambitious, tenacious, and incredibly persistent women, we might still be living in such a world. They could have easily given up their quest at any point, and no one could have blamed them, but they never once wavered. We have these women to thank for the fact that today, when a little girl dreams of becoming a doctor, that dream can become a reality." Let's talk about that a bit. Your book rightly decries the sexist mindset that used to be a given. And in a way, it also recreates the mindset for us in order to show us what intellectually gifted women were up against. And I think you actually have already answered that question, but it's just amazing to me, even though I've known about this, but your book really makes a vivid portrayal of what that was like. And I say men and women because in some of the cases of these women pioneers, their mother was more against their project than the fathers.
Absolutely. They would face just as much sexism. Sexism could easily be internalized. So when they would go to women for fundraising efforts or something for a women's medical center, some of the women would be like, oh my gosh, no, I would never go to a woman doctor. That's ridiculous. I would never trust a woman to know about my body. So yes, it was across the board. And I also wanted to show that it wasn't all men against all women, right? There were men who stood up for these women. There were men who said, okay, yes, you can come to my class, I'll teach you. Or once they got kicked out of a class or something, there was a man who would say, oh, I'll tutor you privately so you can get this certification. And there were also men who would help the women during these riots. So they helped protect them. They took up the mantle of walking them, being their escorts on campus. So it wasn't straight down gender lines of all the women are for this women's movement and all the men are against this women's movement. I thought that was really important nuance to portray. But yeah, these women would get their moms were not about this because a lot of times these were the upper middle class or upper class women. And having a job just wasn't what you did, right? Like the jobs were for lower class women. So that was the main argument. A lot of times it was specifically about being a doctor because that was really grotesque. Like that, if you're really pushing it, if you want to go be a school teacher, maybe, or go be a writer, be a poet, something a little more prim and proper. But to go and decide to, you know, poke around inside human bodies, that was not okay. Their mothers flew into depressive episodes and forbade them from going. There's one that said she'd rather see her daughter in an insane asylum than a medical school. This was intense from their families. They had no support. Their families would just cut them off. Basically, they had to raise their own funds to go to medical school in most cases. There was a few cases where their family would support them or their parents were passed away or something. A lot of women had to wait until their dads died because it was against his wishes before they could go to medical school. Kind of across the board, lack of support, both from family and society, but they still wanted to go through with this. They still did what they did. That was incredible to me.
For a woman wanting to become a doctor, that was absolutely scandalous. It was scandalous. And if they're coming from upper class, not all of them did. Elizabeth Backwell, I think, wasn't. But if you were coming from the upper class in particular, that kind of scandal could ruin your family's reputation. And it also can ruin supposedly the marriage chances for the woman, because how attractive can it be for a woman to do something so unfeminine?
Absolutely. Like their families were basically thinking they're going to ruin their lives. Yeah, they're going to ruin their reputation. It didn't matter if your brother was a doctor or your dad was a doctor. You were not going to be a doctor because you would never get a marriage proposal. You would just, their name would be mud in proper society. Yes, exactly.
And let's also give a little context about the field of medicine in the mid-19th century when this is taking place. The level of knowledge, of course, is rudimentary by today's standards. as was the credentialing process. And yet there was already a serious effort to ground medicine in scientific principles. So tell us about what the stage of medicine was like. The leeches were used heavily. Of course, that had been happening for many centuries. Heavy metals, poisonous substances were being used. There were no antibiotics, of course, yet. The surgery was done under non-sterile conditions. So people would often die from that or die during childbirth because physicians were doing autopsies and then immediately doing childbirths with no washing of hands. Really, it sounds like... Were doctors like more dangerous than not having a doctor? And yet there's already, I think, an inkling that medicine would be put on a firmer footing pretty soon.
That was one of the most interesting things to me in doing this research. I had no idea, first of all, how little education was going on and to become a doctor at the time. There were doctors who had never attended a childbirth in their training who suddenly would appear at the woman's bedside and be like, all right, let's deliver this baby. It's their both of their first times, right? Like, that had to be terrifying for everyone involved just to go to school for just a few years and then say, okay, I'm a doctor now. I was shocked by this. But it was a really fascinating time to be researching this because I could really see where medicine was going, right? So we have Elizabeth Blackwell, who's about 10 years older than the two younger women in the story. So she's very much still in that humoral medicine, the purging, the medicine that's probably going to hurt you more than it's going to help you. But the thought was that it was something that made you sweat it out, to vomit it out. Same with the leeches, we're going to pull something out of you. And yes, the surgeries that had to be fast, not accurate, speed over accuracy.
Because of the lack of anesthesia, right?
Exactly, yeah. You had guys holding you down and they would just go, but when it was the speed record for surgery. That's what you were after before there was anesthesia. And most people probably would have passed out, but it's still. So then with the younger women, we see they're 10 years later, they're entering medical education and things are starting to change. We have rapid advances happening where we do discover hand washing and we germ theory and the kind of cleanliness starts to replace that really foul dirtiness of the dark ages of medicine. So I really liked seeing that moment in history through these women's eyes and how it played out in their interactions with each other. Because I know Elizabeth Blackwell was very skeptical of surgery and Lizzie Garrett was not. Lizzie was gung-ho on surgery. She loved that she could knock people out and do abdominal surgeries because she was in the era of anesthesia. So I thought it was a really interesting time to be writing about this because you could see where it was going. And a lot of these women had, because they were forced to study in mainland Europe because of sexism, that's where all these advances were happening. So they brought these back to America and to the UK. So they were really at the forefront of medicine. They started anesthesia things, cleanliness in the surgical room, just all kinds of things. These women were really ahead of their time. And the men at some of their hospitals were like, what is all this newfangled European craft that you're trying to get us into? And they stuck to their guns and this is the way of the future. This is what we're going to be doing. And Elizabeth Blackwell, honestly, I wouldn't classify her as like a dark ages humoral doctor, honestly, because she was really into prevention and that was radical as well. So she pioneered this idea of opening the windows, fresh air, good food, like these sort of preventative ideas that were very new and also very cutting edge. And the training, she created basically what we know as social work. She sent doctors out into the slums to teach women how to take better care of their kids and how to keep house better. So they were really at the cutting edge of medicine. And that was really fascinating to me.
And you mentioned going on into the slums. Because at various points, women couldn't get field placements or in hospitals and such, they had to create their own hospitals or their own clinics. And one way to do that was to serve the poor and have it funded by donations from rich people. And that seemed to be a pretty common strategy for the original women doctors, both here and in Great Britain.
Yeah, so Elizabeth Blackwell, she was not welcomed. No one wanted to hire her. No one wanted to consult for her. No one. She just was, and she wasn't rich. Like you said, she was not one of these upper class women. She had to fund her entire medical education. She was rationing her coal and her food when she had her private practice, because that's all she could do was private practice. But yes, she started giving lectures in well-off Quaker areas, and they funded a lot of her programs. And yes, her practice backed up to a very big poor immigrant area in New York. So she really tried her best to transform these women's lives. This was, of course, when women doctors were only treating women and children. The women were not going to be treating men until the next generation on. But yeah, so Elizabeth Blackwell, once she found her niche there in treating the poor, that's when her really took off in her practice. Like, people started realizing how good she was and that this was the real deal, and she really was a doctor. The other, like, lady doctors in town were abortionists, and that's pretty much all they did. So that's what people assumed that Elizabeth Blackwell was. And once they realized that she was a family doctor, it was a different story.
So there's an extra layer of prejudice there because of the assumption of being an abortionist. You mentioned about the women doctors treating women and children. And part of that was because men wouldn't necessarily trust them. But the other part of that is that women patients really appreciated having a woman doctor. And it's, I think you beautifully bring out in your book how many women patients testified that they wouldn't tell their doctors, their male doctors, their problems with their reproductive system, because it was just too embarrassing. So there was a real need for women doctors just on that score alone.
That was a big reason they would advocate for their own education. And then once they had gotten their degrees and they were certified to practice, they had women coming in. And then those women would then tell other women, oh, I can finally tell someone all my troubles. So that was a big part of the advertising, basically, once they had established themselves, was to have people basically publish articles and magazines and other places to saying, finally, I can talk to someone about all of my problems and not be worried about propriety or, like, because when men did a exam, they wouldn't look directly at your reproductive organs. They put a towel over you. Even when they delivered your baby, they were putting towels and blankets over you and sticking their hand up there.
It wasn't like in surgeries where they put a towel or a cover everywhere, but where they're doing the surgery, they put a towel over what they were supposed to be looking at.
There was so much worry about propriety that you weren't getting good medical care from someone of a different gender. And that's really was their soapbox for a long time, was these women need women to talk to. They're dying really painful deaths because they can't talk about what's really bothering them. And also the riots were a reason they used. They took that horrible event that could have been really totally turning them off. And they said, this is why you need women doctors. Do you want your daughters being treated by these men who would scream and throw stuff at women just because we appeared here? They were really savvy in that way. And they weren't going to let them scare them away, first of all. But then they used it to say, this is why we're here. This is why we're doing what we're doing.
So your book is one of both history and biography, and it was fascinating to get to know the major characters, their personalities, and their amazing perseverance in overcoming obstacle after obstacle in establishing the rights of women to become recognized physicians. So here in the U.S., of course, we talked about Elizabeth Blackwell being the first pioneer, and in the U.K., Lizzie Garrett and Sophia Jex Blake as being two trailblazers who happened to have diametrically different personality styles. So let's hear about these women, how these women approached the steadfast opposition of the male medical establishment and how they, against all odds, kept their eyes on the goals. How were they different and what worked well for which obstacles?
That was another thing that really drew me to this story, is these totally disparate personalities of these three women made for such a lively story. Like, it wasn't exactly, it was a little bit of infighting, but here, let's call it that. I felt like it was a great opportunity to show that women are not a monolith. And this was a very small group of women at the time, right? You think, oh, they have all the same ideas and goals, and they have the same ideas about how to achieve those goals. No, absolutely not. They did not agree on many major points. So I love Sophia. She is a firebrand. She is just such a loudmouth, and she got stuff done. I really believe she's the reason that we got as far as and as fast as we did on the point of women in medicine. Honestly, the group hated her. The group hated what a loudmouth she was and how outspoken she was. She was not a prim and proper lady. So they didn't think she was a good mouthpiece. So Elizabeth Blackwell, and of course, is older. She's from a different generation. I wouldn't necessarily even call her a feminist, honestly. She was made fun of the women's rights, the suffragettes in New York that were like right near where she was going to college. She didn't really align herself with those mainstream feminist groups.
And she had a poor opinion of most women, too.
yeah, exactly. Like, she was a very odd person to me, but she really dedicated herself to, she wanted to be the first woman physician, right? Like, her mentor was like, oh, you're not going to get in any college. Just go to Europe and dress as a man and get a medical degree and then come back here. And she's like, no, that defeats the whole purpose of me being a woman getting a medical degree. So there's a really, really, she's a really interesting character because she isn't what we would consider a feminist, and yet she's such a feminine trailblazer. Like, it was a really interesting dichotomy. So then we have Lizzie, who is a very prim and proper lady. She's got all these men fawning over her. She's got several marriage proposals where Elizabeth has never got married. She was very odd.
And Lizzie does eventually get married too.
Yes, Lizzie does accept. One of the men that proposed actually married her younger sister, who was also a famous feminist suffragette. Yes, Lizzie is very much enmeshed with the women's rights movement in London. She's working with women who are like trailblazing in just women's education in general. She's like best friends with the woman who establishes one of the first women's colleges there. So she's really a part of the movement. She believes in this movement. But both Lizzie and Elizabeth, because they're, I don't know that Lizzie's old school, but they're just much more proper. They didn't want to step on men's toes. They felt it was more strategic to align themselves with men and try to appeal to men in a language that they would appreciate. They knew that they needed male support to achieve acceptance because men hold the key to the mainstream medical establishment. So they needed to, if they needed to get in that door, they had to be working well with men, right? They couldn't fully ostracize all men and still do what they wanted to do. They would never get a job at a regular hospital. They would never be able to go to a regular medical school. They would forever be forced to have their own separate schools and hospitals and all these things. So the ultimate goal was always fully enmeshed in the already set up system, because that's where all the money was. That's where all the good teachers were, all of these things. So they were willing to go slow and let the men get on board in their own time, say, okay, they'll get used to it eventually, mindset. And yes, Lizzie did get married. She had 3 kids. She had performed surgery while she was pregnant. She was incredible. The medical journals wrote about how she was going to be doing it all, how, having a job and having a family. It was like the first major example of that. And I love that. So then we have Sophia. Sophia was a lesbian. She did not care at all what men thought about her and her ideas. She said whatever she wanted to. She has one of the sharpest minds I've ever read about. Like the speed and wit of the comebacks that she had in these meetings. She would stand up in a meeting to talk about women's education or women in medicine. And she would just off the cuff these amazing speeches. She was incredible. She said, why should we wait for men to get on board with this? This is ridiculous. How long is that even going to take? We just need to go do what we're going to do and they'll figure it out. But the women in the movement didn't really like that. They thought that was too much, right? She was too loud. She was too outspoken. She was too brash. She was too male, basically, as well. She wasn't behaving like a woman. She was behaving like a man. And so that wasn't acceptable. She got kicked out of so many organizations that she started to further the cause of women in medicine. And I hated that because it was her that got them there in the first place.
And she eventually became depressed or despairing when she was kicked out of the medical school that she had started in London, women's medical school. And so she was depressed for what, maybe a year or two. And then she started another one in Scotland.
That's right. Yeah. It was her idea to create the London School of Medicine for Women, the first women's medical school in the UK. And she pulls the two Elizabeths on board with her. She says, your reputations will bring this to life. If I don't have your support, then no one's going to believe in this institution. She, even though she didn't agree or get along with either of these women, she knew strategically that their support, success of her endeavor, was hinging on their support. While she was away doing her certification to get a license, just doing an exam, finally in Ireland, they let them go take the exam. Because she had finished all her degree at the University of Edinburgh, and they had said, no, we're not going to award you your degree. So she had to find licensure another way. So finally, Ireland said, yes, we'll let women take the exam. So while she was out taking her exam, they kicked her off the board of the school that she created because she just wasn't the mouthpiece that they were looking for. So yeah, she was just wrecked. It really, and on, why wouldn't she be? This was crazy treatment for her. So yeah, she went back to Edinburgh and started another women's medical school. The school didn't really go anywhere because one of the students was angry with her after a while. But then she founded a women's hospital and a private practice there. The women's hospital is still there today. So that was her legacy.
So let's talk a little bit more about the male authority figures that you describe in your book in charge of the medical institutions. And as depicted in your book, they strike me as in pathetically weak. Pathetically weak men, I have to say. I'm a man, but I have to admit it. They agree to admit women to their medical schools, then rescind the invitation, allow them to attend for a time, then expel them in various times and places. They avoid responsibility for their decisions by letting their students vote on the matter, but only after biasing the students to vote against them to begin with. But the first time with Elizabeth Blackwell, they encourage this vote without priming the students. And Elizabeth gets admitted because the students thought it was a joke. That's such a great twist in the whole story.
That I loved that. So yeah, Elizabeth writes to apply to all these schools. And this is a tiny country college, Geneva, New York. And she's convinced she's not going to get anywhere. Everyone's telling her no. Basically, for men, it was just a matter of saying, hey, I want to come to your school, and you could go. This wasn't like it is today. This isn't like a stringent process of admissions. They didn't care what you had going on before this. And also, so shocking to me, being a doctor was like your third choice as a man. This is what, where you sent your like troublesome son once he couldn't be a minister or he couldn't be a lawyer. Like, this is not the profession that we know today of being really something to be proud of.
It didn't have the esteem, and partly because the whole profession was not all that advanced. And as we talked about earlier, it did as much harm as good, if not more. So it's understandable that it wasn't such a high profession yet.
Right. Yeah. So this was a rough and tumble crowd at these schools. And it was just a matter of saying, hey, I want to come for men. So anyone could come. Elizabeth's mentor was friends with the administrators of this particular college. So they didn't want to say no outright to her. They felt like it might damage their relationship with her mentor. So they were like, okay, we're going to let the students decide whether a woman can come. They're like, put it to a vote. Like you said, they're like, okay, what do you think? Should we let a woman come be a student? And they thought it was a joke by a rival college, just like pulling their leg, right? Doing a prank on them. So they're like, oh yeah, sure. Yeah, totally. This woman, if she really exists, sure, she can come. Here a few weeks later, here's an actual Elizabeth Blackwell walking into the classroom and they're like, what's going on? She's real, right? So this is not a good way to start. Thinking that you don't even exist. But she faced the least probably sexism during her college years of all the three women, because she just wouldn't stand for it. She was much older than them. They saw her as an older sister type character. And a few times they would kind of mess with her and she would shut it down immediately. She just didn't even participate. So they realized from the get-go that she was very no-nonsense and she wasn't going anywhere.
She was no nonsense, but was able to do it in a somewhat feminine way. as opposed to Sophia Jex Blake. She was just very skilled socially, it sounds like.
Yes, she was very plain and very aesthetic. She didn't have a lot of money, but she'd have people stopping her on the street, women staring at her, and she was really getting ogled just because of who she was. So she was like a sideshow almost because, oh, this woman in medical school, what is this? And, you know, she was the talk of this tiny town. But she just kept her head held high and continued on, and she didn't really engage in any of it. Like, she just wasn't going to stoop to their level of gossip or anything like that. And she was just here to learn, and that was it.
Yeah, so in public, she came across, it sounds like, as just very straightforward and focused and unbothered. But she wrote, "Consider how women stand in this matter, how alone, how unsupported. No libraries, museums, hospitals, dispensaries, clinics, no endowments, scholarships, professorships, prizes to stimulate and reward study, no recognized position, no societies, meetings, and professional companionship. All these things men have, none of them are open to women. One can hardly conceive a more complete isolation."
They had nothing. Like, she was shocked by how much she was pushed out or kept out from all of these things. Like, she was able to get into this one tiny school and they had some decent equipment, but beyond that, after she graduated, she was out of luck. Like I said, no one wanted to give her jobs, no one wanted to admit her to any society. And she was, I believe that paragraph she was saying as a asking for funding for the, basically saying the reason why that there should be a women's medical college, separately, if I remember correctly. But she first established her private practice. And once she finally was making money there and people realized that she was the real deal, then she expanded to have to take inpatients, right? So she was having, and her sister also, Emily, of course, is, you know, the forgotten sister. She was, the third or fourth woman to become a doctor in America. But if you're not the first, no one remembers your name. But Emily was an amazing surgeon. She was incredible. So along with her sister and a few other women, she opened an inpatient facility. And that's when she started to realize she had a lot of students come from the Women's Medical School in Philadelphia, because that was the first one. It wasn't founded by women. It was founded by Quakers, I believe. But they had a lot of students that come and train at this hospital. That was her first realization that women had nowhere to train. She'd been through it. But now she was seeing more and more women entering the profession, and where were they going to train? Because regular hospitals were turning them down. So first of all, there needed to be women's hospitals for women to train at. So that's what she offered. In addition to women's healthcare, she offered training for these women students. She wasn't really impressed with the caliber of the students that were coming from Philadelphia. So she was like, I need to start up my own medical college in New York. And it's going to be really high level quality. It's going to be really stringent standards for letting people in and graduating people. And so finally she did this as well. So this is the third or fourth. There was one medical school in New York by, I think it was a homeopathic male doctor. And then there was one in Boston and one in Philadelphia. So I think this was the third or fourth women's medical school, but it was very high caliber. And Sophia actually came to study there for a few months.
Yes. Yeah, so Elizabeth, as I mentioned earlier, had a surprisingly low opinion of other women. She said that between men and women, there will always be an intellectual difference. And she couldn't imagine a world in which expectations of women would be such that they could be as intellectually curious as men. At least she said that earlier. But then when she spent time in England, she found some like-minded women, high caliber intellectually. And it sounds like she started to change her tune on that a little bit.
I would say yes. I think she was really socialized. She was of her time. How you can't exactly blame her. She tells stories. I don't remember if this got cut or if it stayed in the book, of when she was a kid and the minister would come visit and her brothers were like showing off how strong they were.
It's in the book.
Okay. I can't remember if it stayed or not. We cut a lot of different parts of her history from when she went to teach in other places. So yeah, she like volunteers to pick up the priest and carry him around the house to show how strong she is. Like, so she's had this really deeply embedded sense of women needing to show that they're just as blank. They're just as strong. They're just as smart. So this idea has always been with her. And I think she denies this a little bit later in life. And you can't really help but think that she's only been exposed to women that haven't had the opportunities and education to become curious-minded women. The women that she was around were boring because they were had been socialized that they were just going to go find a man. Women didn't get as good an education, so they weren't going to be as intellectually stimulating for conversation as a man was. So you can understand where she was coming from if you think about it within the context. I'm not saying she was right. I'm just saying I can see how she had the ideas that she did. And then, yes, as she traveled, she went to Paris to study the maternity hospital. She's in London talking to different doctors. She and Florence Nightingale were best buds. They had a falling out because Florence Nightingale thought that women should only be nurses and not doctors. And they were going to open a women's medical school together. But Florence Nightingale was like, in the end, was like, no, I don't want women to train as doctors. I think women should be nurses. So that was an interesting interaction as well. So we think of Elizabeth as not as forward-thinking in her feminism, but then she was more forward-thinking than Nightingale was. So there, it was definitely a range of ideas going on at the time about what women could do and be. And Elizabeth was getting further towards the top of that and thinking that women were capable of more than, much more than society expected of them, the more that she was exposed to other countries and other situations where she would meet women that had the education required to become intellectually curious.
One really interesting point that you make is that there was a question of how women should be and act among the men. And this is still very timely, I think, not quite to the same extent, but you write, this is a tightrope that women must always walk on to constantly have to wonder, am I being friendly enough? Am I being overly friendly? As women began entering previously men-only professions and educational spaces, these became near constant calculations in careers and subjects across the board.
I think it's very timely. I think women are always making these calculations still to this day. Is what I'm wearing, is what I'm saying, is my tone of voice, is it going to come across the right way? Am I going to be perceived as professional, or am I going to be perceived as angry or soliciting some sort of relationship in a more than professional way? This is something that women always think about all the time, I promise you.
No, I know. That's why I bring it up.
it's a lot. And to see these calculations happening during these first mixed gender professional situations was really fascinating. So that was another reason that they had to be protective of what they were doing. What does she say? Something like, all it would take was one wrong woman to ruin our whole movement. All it would take, basically, was what she's saying, was one woman who was only there to find a husband. This is something that women get accused of all the time. You're only in this job to find a husband. You're only at this expensive university to find a rich husband. Like these kind of, it's a way to put women down, the whole, you're sleeping your way to the top. These kinds of ideas of women are only there for one reason used to put women down. And that they had to always be thinking about this already in the Victorian era. It's like, wow, we've been doing this for a long time. I'm sure even before that. But yeah, always wondering. And rightly, because they had men from their jobs coming up to them and proposing marriage. Of course, it was a little bit different then. It wasn't like you would be dating for a long time. It was more like, you're a good match, let's get married kind of thing. You only had ever had a few conversations, or you'd only ever been friends or something, and then suddenly there's a marriage proposal. But yes, that situation, like suddenly there's a proposal, that made her rethink her behavior again. Like she's got to, okay, let's reassess. What did I do wrong? So you're constantly thinking, okay, I don't want to be inviting proposals. I don't want these men to think that I'm attracted to them. What can I do differently? What can I do better? And these were things that the men were not considering. Men never had to consider these things. So that was a whole other layer that they had to be aware of, that they had to contend with.
And then the other dimension of something to be preoccupied with is that in order to get recognition and acceptance, they had to outperform. They didn't have to just do as well. They had to outperform the men, both in class and the class participation and on the exams. And they did. And of course, that led to tremendous resentment by the men when they outperformed the men once. Said, we can't do this. They're going to take our professions away from us.
Yeah, you had to be good. You were the first. So that was a huge responsibility. The first women to attend medical school in different countries, the first to practice medicine. You had to be above reproach, but you also had to be prove your intellectual mettle. You had to prove that you were there for a reason. If you were failing classes, you were failing all of womankind because you were showing the detractors that they were right, that women weren't capable of this. So yes, you had to study your butt off because if you weren't passing the courses, you were going to wreck it for everyone that came behind you. So there was so much pressure. They had so much riding on them here. And of course not. Some of the women in Edinburgh, they didn't all go through the whole course. Some of them dropped out, but others did the entire course and it didn't ruin anything. But because the University of Edinburgh said to these seven women who did finish and graduate technically that they weren't going to award their degree, it infuriated Lizzie and Elizabeth. They're like so mad with Sophia. They're like, this experiment failed. You've ruined everything because you didn't get the degree. You didn't fulfill the promise. So women can't come behind you and onto this path. So what are we going to do? They were always finding reasons to be mad at poor Sophia. That wasn't her fault that this college was like, no, you can't have your degree, even though you've done everything that you're supposed to do. But again, they're fighting about how much this was going to push the movement back.
So I'm not sure to what extent you write about this in the book, but were these women or some of these women still alive when the barriers really started to tumble down, not just in a small way, but in a big way, where suddenly there were hundreds and hundreds of female medical students?
So what was really interesting to me was Lizzie's daughter also became a surgeon, and she worked during the war, and it was her that ushered in women treating men. So Lizzie got to see her daughter expand the profession even further. So I thought that was incredible. And Lizzie also became like a mayor of a little town. They definitely saw women's rights expand in a huge way. And I want to say they probably all lived to see women accepted into regular medical schools, regular colleges. Because I think it was at that point that either these women's schools would be absorbed into a regular school or shut down because they were no longer needed. So yeah, I think so. I think they all saw more of it happen.
And I noticed toward the end of your book, you couldn't help writing this paragraph, and this would be fighting words for men. Recent research shows women may actually be better doctors. They are more likely to follow clinical guidelines and provide preventive care than their male counterparts. Data from 1.5 million hospitalizations concluded that patients treated by women are significantly less likely to die or to be readmitted. Patients operated on by female surgeons are all less likely to die. Wow. And of course, you're not talking about all women and all men, but just statistically.
Yeah, and actually, since that's been published, there's been even more studies showing the same thing, that women are better surgeons, women are better practitioners. And I think it's that layer of women knowing that they're going to face more scrutiny at this job, like especially in surgery, is a very male-coded job still. And I think it's a sort of a boys' club. There are definitely still areas of medicine that are boys' clubs and where men make more money, or men are always holding the higher jobs. Women are rarely in authority. So I think it's that idea that in these traditionally male jobs, women are facing extra scrutiny, and they know they need to always be aware that they're going to be put to a higher standard. And so they perform.
You're not claiming they have innate superiority, but it's at least partly situational, that it's because of the pressures and the scrutiny and the expectations.
That's my interpretation of it. I'm sure I'm not a physician, so the physicians might have another idea entirely, but I definitely think that's part of it. And I don't think men are more sloppy naturally or anything like that. I think it's just that women have to be proving themselves all through medical school and all through their residencies and things, that they have to be really dotting their I's and crossing their T's the whole time, or they're gonna, because men are gonna gleefully point them out when they're not. So they've learned to do that, go the extra mile.
And the flip side is that men have been doctors during the heyday of medicine, when doctors were put on pedestals, which can lend itself to a certain level of arrogance. Arrogance and sloppiness, I think, can sometimes go together. And if you haven't been pedestalized in that way, you're maybe a little bit less prone to making those kinds of errors.
That's a really good point. Absolutely.
As you talk about in your book, the struggle for women to become doctors was happening on both sides of the Atlantic, and that France was the first to establish a clear policy of admitting women to medical school. And Mary Putnam studied at the Sorbonne in Paris. So she was another lesser character in your book, but not a lesser character in the history.
No, she was fascinating. And yeah, I think there's a biography just of her coming out soon. I got to read an advanced copy and blurb. It was very good. So yeah, she's definitely deserving of her own story. She's a fascinating person. She documented her death. Basically, she documented her disease progression. So that's also a fascinating aspect. She was definitely a member of the younger generation of women in medicine, like Sophia, in that she was pushing against Elizabeth Blackwell's dated ideas. And she would do research studies to prove, or rather disprove, the ideas for why women shouldn't pursue education, for why women couldn't be doctors. There was this idea that on your period, women don't have as much energy, that if they engage in hard physical or mental labor, that it's going to render them sterile. So this is one way of keeping women out of education, right? It's going to mean that you don't have babies later on. That's your whole point, is women is to have babies, pursue education while you're on your period, you're going to become sterile. Mary Putnam Jacobi was like, no, this is not true, and she's going to prove it with science. So she does an actual study to prove this, and she publishes the study, and she's no, this is, I can prove with this data, that's absolutely incorrect. So that's what I love about her. I love this idea that not just that she's going to argue, which is what a lot of these women did, like they would be back and forth with men in medical journals about what women could and couldn't do. Well, Mary Putnam Jacobi, she's going to prove it. And she's fabulous. I love her.
So she proved that evolution was not against women doctors, right? And they would still have offspring.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. Oh, my goodness.
So this is a somewhat minor part of your book, but what's interesting is there was an intersection between some of these women and some really famous people. So you mentioned about Florence Nightingale, but I don't know if it was Lizzie Garrett or Elizabeth Blackwell, who met up with John Stuart Mill, who was a philosopher in England, who was one of the first male writers who could be considered a feminist. He wrote The Subjection of Women around that time.
That was Lizzie in her role with the women's rights movement in London. I think there's a drawing somewhere of her and one other person from this women's rights organization secretly delivering a manuscript or something for him to take to the government for them to sign or something. It's really, yeah. So she, and there was a, I think it was one of the princesses appeared at her practice one time. She was very well known. Lizzie was fairly famous. And so she got a lot of more famous patients, and where Elizabeth was eyed as an oddity, we have Lizzie in London as being like the hot dinner guest ticket. Like she's like a cool person to have around. So it's like they're having very different experiences. Once Lizzie had become a doctor, then suddenly she was like a fascinating party guest to be invited out all the time. But she always made a point of being very feminine when she went out. She would wear fancy dresses and, you know, fine laces and velvets and things, whereas Elizabeth was never invited out and just not, you know, she wasn't very social. Like she said, she was very isolated, very lonely. She was very ascetic. She hated spending money. She had very plain things.
She was puritanical in her views, too.
Very much, yes. So we have Lizzie, who is much more lavish. So she's getting visits from the prince. She's dealing with the feminist movements, meeting with famous thinkers and writers of the time and lawmakers. And so, yes, she's a really interesting figure in that sense as well.
And Lizzie also was helped to sit for her exam by the Empress Eugenie Bonaparte, the wife of Napoleon.
Yeah, so she also went to the Sorbonne because she got her license to practice medicine from the Society of Apothecaries. So she could legally practice medicine, but she wasn't officially an MD. And she didn't like that. She wanted to be officially an MD. She wouldn't even write doctor on her like sign of her practice because she didn't think she was technically a doctor yet. So she spent a few months traveling and to Paris back and forth. I think she went to take all her exams that she needed. And she had to fight to be admitted, but it was a big to-do there as well to be a woman at the Sorbonne. That was a big deal. And it took a lot of finagling for her to get in there in the first place. And she finally got her MD.
And Lizzie was the one whose mother was so against her becoming a doctor that she fell into a supposed depression, and Lizzie was getting letters, your mom's going to die or something like that. And meanwhile, her father, who had originally opposed, pretty quickly took Lizzie's side, and so much so that when Lizzie was announced that she was getting married, her father was against it because it would affect her career.
Yeah, that was a really sweet relationship progression. I really like that. Yeah, her mom was not about it at all. She was, she's one of those, it's going to ruin your chances of marriage. It's going to ruin the family. You know, what are you thinking? She made herself ill from crying so much about it. Yeah, she'd get progressively more morose letters from her, probably threatening things like she was going to kill herself or something. Like, it was intense. Like, her mother really didn't want her to do this. She thought it was ruining her life. But she brought her dad with her when she first set out to try to become a doctor, figure out how she could do this. So they're going to the street where all the doctors work in London. So she's going with her dad to speak to these different doctors about how she should go about becoming a doctor, getting the training that she needed. And most of the men are like laughing at her. Oh, you're going to charge money for this? What do you think you're doing? You can't do this. And so that's when, as her father witnessed this, he has a huge change of heart and he starts defending her. Why are you telling my daughter that she can't do it, what she wants? Why? How do you have any right to say things like that to her? So that really, seeing that sexism in action is what really changed his mind, I think. And yes, the more setbacks she got thrown, the more he wanted to see her succeed. Like, he was really in her corner. They were fairly well to do. So when she had her private practice, they were sending her hampers of food and allowance money and all this kind of stuff. So like, she wasn't going to starve or anything, but yeah, her dad's supporting her. And then in the end, like, saying, why do you really want to get married? Is this really what you want? What about your practice? Like, that, it was a really sweet relationship. I like that.
And then her father was not afraid of showing his own feminine side, because at the wedding, he was the one who was bawling as she's walking down the aisle. She walked down the aisle alone, not wearing white, not being accompanied. She really was an amazingly forward-thinking on all of that as well.
Yeah, she was very fun.
And her husband was very supportive of her career, and she did not have to compromise her career one bit after she married.
This was a very modern thing. This was not done for two people to be married and they go off to work during the day and they come back in the evening. That didn't exist then, right? Unless you were lower class and you were working in domestic service or factories. So in the upper classes, a woman sat around at home or oversaw the home. So for them both to leave and then come back in the evening, that was radical. It was revolutionary in and of itself. And then to add kids, she's not a bad mom, but she wasn't really into the little baby stage of kids. And of course they had nannies and that kind of thing. But her biography is written by her daughter. So she talks about the ways that she did show that she cared and the ways that she was a good mom in this way and not that way. I think she was a really interesting character all around.
I think we have time just for maybe one final thought. And I was just curious what you think, and maybe you don't know, but what do you think is like the next stage of gender equality when it comes to professional life?
Oh gosh, it's just, so many women aren't being supported on their way up, right? So if you can see, there's more women in medical school than there are men, and there has been for the past few years. But as you go further up through residencies, through the hierarchy at colleges and hospitals, fewer and fewer women. So I think where organizations need to look now is how you can support women in continuing their careers and getting to those higher positions. So it's not that they're not going for it, they don't want it, but that they're maybe not getting the support that they need on the way.
This has been wonderful. Olivia Campbell, journalist, essayist, and author, including of the 2021 New York Times bestseller, Women in White Coats, How the First Women Doctors Changed the World of Medicine. Thank you so much for coming on to Delving In.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fantastic. My next book, if I'm allowed to talk about it for 1 second, is Sisters in Science. It's about four women physicists escaping the Nazis. So it's a little bit of a deviation from medicine, but it's still about women in science. So this is an even harder, even bigger stack of research to deal with. But no, it was really fascinating, and I'm excited.
When do you estimate that book would come out?
That's coming out in December 31st of this year.
Oh, wow. I definitely would love to have you back on to talk about that book.
Fantastic.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
I'm Stuart Kelter, and you have been listening to the podcast edition of Delving In, originally broadcast on KTALLP, the community radio station in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Please visit our website, lccommunityradio.org, and see what KTAL has to offer. We appreciate listener donations to help us stay on the air and to continue to grow in cyberspace.